Good day, everyone. I'm Ridgely Ox, Healthcare Coordinator for CBU. Today's virtual training, sponsored by a grant from the Commonwealth Fund, will look at the Affordable Care Act, which once again faces an existential crisis. In healthcare, there's no more high-stakes case than Texas versus the United States, which will decide the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. On July 9th, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in the case. No one is better able to unpack the various twists and turns of this highly unusual case or its potential ramifications than Katie Keith, who writes following the ACA blog for Health Affairs. She's also a part-time research faculty member at Georgetown Center on Health Insurance Reforms and a principal at Keith Policy Solutions. She's joined by moderator Shira Stein, healthcare oversight reporter at Bloomberg Law. I just want to tell everyone who's listening, if you have any questions during the conversation, send them to cebu@cebu.org, and we will pass them on to Shira. So welcome, Katie and Shira, and everybody else, and let's start digging in.
Hi. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and thank you to the Commonwealth Fund. So I'm going to start off with a little short description, and then we're going to get right into the conversation. In 2017, the Republican Congress decided to zero out the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate penalty. That was the tax that people paid for not having insurance. As a result of that, a group of 20 Republican attorneys general and two individuals filed a case arguing that because the Supreme Court upheld the law based on Congress's ability to tax in 2012, the lack of a penalty means that the individual insurance markets are unconstitutional. Two Republican attorneys general in Ohio and Montana have withdrawn from the case since then. About three dozen Democratic attorneys general and the Democratic House of Representatives have intervened in the lawsuit. And as Ridgely said, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments a few weeks ago on the case, and we're expecting a decision sometime this fall. So Katie, can you talk a little bit about what the arguments were that the two sides made in the district court case originally?
Yeah, thank you so much, Shira, and thank you to CBU and Commonwealth Fund for having me. It seems like a really good time to be having this discussion as we continue to have to deal with some of these court decisions. So, you know, if we go back in time to think about the district court case, as you mentioned, originally this was a lawsuit brought by 20 Republican state attorneys general and governors, later joined by two individuals in Texas. That was February of last year. You know, it really is the sort of core argument that you laid out, Shira, that the mandate is now unconstitutional, now that it has been taken from $695 to $0. Really what the Republican AGs are trying to do here is revisit the big 2012 Supreme Court decision on the individual mandate. Most folks remember this case. It's called NFIB versus Sebelius. And so that was the case where Chief Justice John Roberts said, you know, the mandate itself could not be upheld as constitutional under the Commerce Clause, but it could as a tax. And so it was valid under Congress's authority to tax. Now that the mandate, again, has been changed from $695 to $0, the argument is that it can no longer be sustained as a tax. And if it's no longer a tax, Chief Justice Roberts will agree that it's now unconstitutional. And so the argument doesn't stop there, though. So they take it a step further by arguing that the mandate itself is so central and so essential to the entire rest of the Affordable Care Act that if the mandate itself is unconstitutional, the rest of the law should also be struck down. And when I say the rest of the law, it is not just the parts that we think about when we think about Obamacare. A lot of folks, I think that word, ACA or Obamacare, they think about healthcare.gov and protections for people with pre-existing conditions and staying on your parents' plan till you're 26. They think of these sort of core insurance provisions. And, in reality, you know, the bill was about 1,000 pages long, and it really touches every part of the U.S. healthcare system, from the FDA, to menu labeling, to public health, to Medicare. And so they would, if the plaintiffs sort of succeed, and this is what happened in the district court decision, it would really invalidate all these different provisions and have a huge ripple effect, I think, for the economy and for the healthcare system across the country. So that's sort of their core argument. It's sort of two things. the mandate's unconstitutional because it's no longer a tax, and the entire law must be struck down under sort of a severability analysis. There have been a lot of twists and turns in the case in terms of what the Department of Justice has been doing. We're going to cover that in a little while. But sort of the flip side of the argument, right, for folks who are defending the ACA, they're arguing just the opposite. They're arguing that the mandate remains constitutional, that it should not be an issue, that it zeroed out. And they make a variety of reasons or variety of arguments there, which we could get into if it's of interest. Some of those are that the mandate could be sustained under the Commerce Clause now, or, you know, it still looks like a tax, and Congress could come back in at any point and change it from $0 to $5, and then it would still satisfy, you know, the opinion, the rationale made by the Chief Justice back in NFIB. So they're still arguing that the mandate's constitutional. Even if it's not, they're arguing that the rest of the ACA should be what we call severable. And so they're arguing that there's sort of longstanding Supreme Court precedent that says judges should try to do as little harm as possible when they're invalidating core provisions, and that even if the mandate is unconstitutional, the rest of the law should be fine. They also very much point to congressional intent here. And so if you remember back for 2017, the Republican-led Congress, right, both chambers were led by Republicans, they tried really hard for an entire year to repeal the ACA and to repeal much more of it. And folks, you know, culminating in the very dramatic thumbs down from Senator John McCain at the time. And so, you know, leading up to that all year trying to repeal the ACA, and then in December working on the tax reform bill and, you know, simply zeroing out the individual mandate. And so what folks who are defending the ACA are also arguing is that Congress didn't intend to strike down the entire ACA when it changed the mandate penalty. They only meant to change the mandate penalty, and we know that because they tried all year and failed, and this was sort of, you know, more or less the best they could get from their bill. And so those are sort of the two sides of the argument, both at the district court level and increasingly at the Fifth Circuit. I think, again, folks will recall on December 14th, 2018, sort of the eve of the end of open enrollment, we did get this sweeping, extreme decision from Judge Reed O'Connor, who's a federal judge in the Northern District of Texas, and he fully agreed with the plaintiffs. He, you know, agreed that, yes, the mandate is now unconstitutional, and because it is so central to the rest of the ACA, he thought the rest of the law should be invalidated. He did not sort of invalidate the law then and there. He declared that it should be invalid, but then put that decision on hold to allow the appeals process to go forward. So that was a lot, Shira, but I might just sort of pause there and make sure I answered your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you talk a little bit about, there's been a lot of discussion about how unusual Judge O'Connor's decision was in regard to legal norms and all of that. Can you talk about why his decision was so unusual and unexpected?
Sure. It was quite... I'll talk about the decision itself, and then I might talk about why this case is before Judge O'Connor in the first place. That might be the way to do it. Well, yeah. Actually, you know what else? I'll flip those. So Judge Reed O'Connor, folks might have seen his name. I end up having to do – I track pretty much all the litigation that I can that's going on with the Affordable Care Act. There's probably four or five cases I'm tracking in front of Judge Reed O'Connor right now, and it's partially because he's in the Northern District of Texas, as I mentioned. For many years, he was in the Wichita Falls Division of the Northern District of Texas. And why that is important is because he's the only federal judge in that division. And so when the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, leads multi-state Attorney General litigation, and that office has been very prominent in suing the federal government, both under the Obama administration and under the Trump administration, when Texas decides to bring a legal challenge, they often file in the Wichita Falls division, or they did, at least when Judge Reed O'Connor was there. And, you know, I think the thinking there is he's the only judge. He's a very conservative judge. He has done things that are unusual in many other cases, like granting nationwide injunctions. He struck down the DACA program. He invalidated Title IX guidance from the Obama administration that protected transgender students. He has sort of, I think, ruled against the ACA in every case that he has appeared before him. He's quite conservative, but also, I think, sweeping in his decisions. It seems to be more than just sort of a judicial philosophy. He has been very aggressive, I would say, in his approach here. He is now, well, and if folks are interested, the Texas Tribune has done an excellent write-up of kind of his history and his work. And I think in 2015 and 2016, when he was sort of that only judge there, I believe every single one of the Texas-led challenges to federal rules, and again, this is as the Obama administration is waning, were filed before him. He heard every single one of those challenges. And so, you know, I think sometimes folks talk about forum shopping and, you know, when you're looking for a judge or you're looking for maybe a sympathetic district or a sympathetic jury pool or something like that. And, you know, there's sort of this idea that everybody forum shops, right? Lawyers want to find a place where they're going to have a good shot at winning their case. You know, this to me strikes of judge shopping. I mean, this is very, very specific. And folks, I think, were incentivized. They just knew they were going to get Judge O'Connor, who seems to issue what many other folks in the legal community view as extreme decisions. I think he's now in the Fort Worth division of the Northern District of Texas, which I believe makes him one of three judges there, but I'm pretty sure he's the only active judge, which still means it's very likely when you file in that division that you're still going to be before Judge Reed O'Connor. So there are a few folks who have sort of written this up and taken a look at the data, but I think that's sort of a little bit of background about our district court judge here and maybe what his approach would be. And then to your point, Shira, I think there was sort of, it is an extreme decision, particularly on the severability analysis. Well, a couple things, actually. I mean, even on standing. Standing is sort of this legal doctrine where you're supposed, you know, plaintiffs to get into court are supposed to have a real injury that can be, you know, addressed by a court that's traceable to something that the defendants are doing. You know, there's sort of this standard. If there wasn't a standard for when you can sue and who can sue, we might be tied up in lawsuits all the time, right? So you have to have standing to bring a lawsuit in the first place. As I mentioned, this case was originally brought by 20 Republican states and two individuals. And Judge O'Connor, for instance, in his standing analysis, he only looked at whether those two individuals, these are two self-employed people who live in Texas and claimed that they did not want to buy ACA coverage, but that they would continue to do so even if the mandate was zero because they felt compelled to by the law. Now, that's their argument. That's their injury. Is a sort of a financial injury that they are still having to purchase ACA coverage even when the penalty is zero for doing so. Judge O'Connor only looked at their standing, these two individuals. It was a very unusual analysis. It's been sort of panned by ideologically diverse legal scholars. So you have sort of legal scholars who don't like the ACA, folks like Jonathan Adler, Michael Cannon at the Cato Institute, you know, folks who are no friends of this law and frankly were, you know, arguing against the ACA and the previous two Supreme Court decisions who have come in and said, this decision is wrong on standing, on severability, on all kinds of aspects. But that's one example. So I sort of interrupted myself, sorry. Judge O'Connor only looked at the standing of those two people and did not even discuss whether those 20 states had standing. And so we're in a situation where he's issued this sweeping opinion that is really resting on the rights of two people in Texas weighing against 300 million people in the United States and the entire healthcare system. And, you know, and again, sort of didn't even discuss whether the states had standing. On severability, it was a bit of a really, I would call it a tortured analysis. That again has been criticized sort of across the board. So you do have this outcry in the legal community, Shira. You sort of asked, you know, to describe how unusual it was, criticizing many, many parts of this analysis. We've also seen, you know, the Wall Street Journal editorial board come out against his decision, same thing with the National Review. So you have a lot of conservative criticism for this decision as well. But, you know, that might not be taking root, as we sort of heard before the Fifth Circuit oral argument. Shira, maybe that's a good moment to kind of hand it back to you.
Yeah, and so let's bring it back to the administration a little bit. What has been the administration's role in all of this before we move on to the appellate arguments, and how have they changed their position?
No, great question. So in February, you had the Republican states file their case. In April, they were joined by these two individuals in Texas. Almost right away, right after that, I believe in May, California and at the time, 16 other Democratic attorneys general asked to intervene in the case to defend the ACA. At the time, we didn't really have an indication of what the Trump administration was going to do. The assumption is that you were, as a federal government, you're supposed to defend federal law if a reasonable argument can be made in favor of the statute. We have not set up a system where you know, the Department of Justice picks and chooses the laws that it defends in court. That's not really what's supposed to happen. The precedent is if a reasonable argument can be made, that law should be defended. In any event, I think even before knowing the Trump administration's position, California and these other states asked to intervene. So now you have a bunch of states sort of also defending the law. In June of last year was the first time the Trump administration had to weigh in on the lawsuit. And the position that they took, you'll have to hang in with me because it's a little bit confusing, mm-hmm. but they partially agreed with the plaintiffs. So their first position was, we agree that the mandate is unconstitutional. And for them to reach that conclusion, they had to send a letter to, you know, congressional leadership explaining their rationale and saying, you know, they compared it to, I think, when the Obama administration declined to defend the Defense of Marriage Act back in, you know, that case happened many years ago. This was their comparison, that we think the mandate is now unconstitutional. But where they sort of drew the line was on this issue of severability. So they did not think the entire law should be invalidated, like the plaintiffs did, but they did think that core provisions, so an additional four parts of the law, should also be struck down. So they would have the mandate be unconstitutional and ask the court to strike what's called guaranteed issue, community rating, protections against pre-existing condition exclusions, and then another provision on discrimination and health insurance. And so they said, you know, but we think it's, you know, I'm using air quotes, you can't see me, just these provisions. So the mandate and these four other things. Those four provisions are extremely important to making sure that the law works. They're extremely important for protecting people with pre-existing conditions. You know, these are the provisions that mean health insurance companies couldn't deny coverage if you had a health condition, or you couldn't exclude coverage for pre-existing conditions. And so it was not sort of a minor position to take at all. And they've taken a lot of criticism for that. But they kind of took, you know, if you think about it as a spectrum, you had the Republican states on one end saying everything should be thrown out with the ACA. You had the Democratic states on the other end saying everything should be upheld. It's still valid. And then you had initially the Department of Justice carving out this middle lane of saying the mandate's unconstitutional and not everything should go, but some of these core provisions should also be struck down. And they had some reasons why they took that position, which we can get into if that's of interest to folks, but that was their first position. And so they sort of were doing
this. Let me just interrupt just quickly, just when you're mentioning that, just to anybody that's listening that has a question, send them to sabu@sabu.org, and they'll get forwarded to Shira. So I just wanted to interject. Okay, go on. This is great.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Yeah, no, so that was the initial position. And then when Judge O'Connor's decision came out in December, you saw there had to be some procedural maneuvers that happened. But in early January, there was the opportunity to appeal that decision. And you actually saw both the Department of Justice and California-led states appeal the decision up to the Fifth Circuit. So that was sort of a good, and that's right, they lost, right? If their position is the entire law shouldn't go, they lost at the lower court, and so they should appeal that up. Fine. Fast forward, I believe in March of this year, they took a new position. So they filed sort of a two-sentence letter with the court on the day that their brief was due to make their arguments before the appellate court. Those two sentences essentially said, we agree with the plaintiffs. We think the lower court's decision was correct. So we agree with Judge Reed O'Connor's position. And so it left this vacuum where the Department of Justice was no longer defending any parts of the ACA. California and the other states were there to do that, but it sort of fully moved the department. If you think back about that spectrum, it moved the Department of Justice over squarely to the same camp as the Republican-led states and those two individuals who brought the lawsuit in the first place. That was not it, though. And so there's a few wrinkles in there. They sort of seem to suggest, we think most of the law should go, but, you know, we're not convinced that these plaintiffs are harmed by every provision of the ACA. So there's probably some things that could stand. The examples they gave were pretty limited, but they pointed at some sort of criminal healthcare fraud statutes that were enacted as part of the ACA and sort of said, we don't think that those individuals in Texas are harmed by those provisions, so those would be allowed to stay. But that's really all the guidance they gave. They have not sort of walked through and suggested here in the Department of Justice's position is what parts of the ACA could stay and what could go. And so this is, that was kind of a little bit of a wrinkle that ends up being important, but has also been extremely unclear. And then Ridgely mentioned that oral arguments were held on July 9th. The week before that, I think the DOJ took yet a new position. And here, Judge Reed O'Connor's decision had been widely viewed as sort of clearly applying to all 50 states and D.C. I think if you're declaring the entire ACA to be invalid, you're not doing that in some states, but not others. But that is what the Department of Justice sort of all of a sudden, the week before oral argument, seemed to suggest. That now their new understanding of what Judge Reed O'Connor's decision was is that it would only apply in the plaintiff states, so now 18 states led by Republicans, and that would be it. And there's sort of a question about what would happen in California and some of these other states that were not party to the lawsuit on the plaintiff side. So it's really confusing. It's probably really confusing over there because they've taken a bunch of different positions, but that has caused all kinds of sort of procedural ripples and complications. And maybe before I turn it back to you, Shira, just to summarize, like sort of where we are now in terms of all the different parties. On the one side, you have now 18 Republican attorneys general and governors, down from 20 at the start, 18 states, the two individuals and the Department of Justice, so the Trump administration, all on one side arguing that at least most of the ACA should be invalid. On the other side, defending the law, you have now 21 Democratic attorneys general, up from kind of 17 initially, and then you have the House of Representatives, which asked to intervene in the case following the midterm elections. And so almost pretty sure that the day they were sworn in or the first bill they voted on, the House gave itself the authority to intervene in the litigation. And so they've now been a party to the lawsuit pretty much all of 2019. So it's, as you can tell, there's sort of five different parties. Some of them have moved positions. It gets very procedurally complex very quickly, but that's where things are as we await the Fifth Circuit decision.
Yeah, and I think it's important to mention for everyone in all of this that throughout this lawsuit, so when the Justice Department and the Trump administration initially filed their perspective in the case, they had affirmed that they would continue to enforce the law. Since then, they have yet to do that since they changed their position, but they still do continue to enforce the law. So it's important to mention or writing about these things that, yes, this case is confusing and complicated and could result in the entire law being struck down potentially, but Obamacare is still being enforced by this HHS, and they are still moving forward with parts of the law that need to be enforced.
Thank you for saying that. That's exactly right. And, you know, I think for real people who are not following this lawsuit, the message is clear. It's like, you need pay your premiums, your health insurance will still be there, nothing is changing right away. This is a long process, right? Nothing is going to change until we get a final decision from the Supreme Court on something. And so that's, you know, we'll talk about the timing of that, but that's not happening anytime soon. But it is very confusing for people, even having the district court decision come down on the eve of the end of the last open enrollment period where folks are trying to sign up for health insurance and then seeing headlines that the law is unconstitutional. You know, what effect does that or did it have on people understanding their rights or understanding what's going on, how much confusion did it cause, all of that. So I thank you for mentioning that. It really is important. Nothing is changing anytime soon, and people should know they should come to expect the same sort of rights and protections that they've had for, you know, in some cases, 9 years now.
Yeah. We've gotten into this a little bit earlier, but I'd like you to expand, especially as we've gotten into the arguments at the appellate level. There's been a lot of discussion of the issues of standing and jurisdiction in the case. Can you talk about what those issues are and what the different arguments have been made by the parties in the case?
Sure. So, you know, we sort of touched on standing already. There has been, you know, kind of this ongoing question of should we be hearing this case at all? Is anyone actually harmed by a $0 penalty? And that's a real question. You know, if there is no sort of negative repercussion for taking an action, does that harm someone? And does it harm these individuals who insist that they feel compelled to buy health insurance nonetheless? And part of the reason for that is just sort of there's the precedent, right? The precedent with a C of you don't want these cases to just be brought if there's no actual injury to folks. That's not what the judicial system is for. We would get so backlogged if you just kind of had ideologically motivated challenges. You're supposed to have actual injury here. And that is a real question that I think the court's trying to grapple with a little bit. They're also looking, at least asked during the hearing, for instance, that, you know, do the states have, the Republican-led states who also brought the lawsuit, do they have standing here? How are these states harmed by the individual mandate? How are they harmed by the individual mandate at all? And then second, how are they harmed by sort of a penalty-less individual mandate? And the arguments that the states have been making, at least, is that there are going to be at least some people who do what those two individuals are doing, and they're going to, at least someone is going to feel compelled to still get health insurance because they want to follow the law, even if there's no penalty, and that at least some of those people are going to enroll in those states' Medicaid and CHIP programs. I think it's a big stretch. And so one of the things that California and the House have pointed out to this argument is that they really, the states have not met their evidence burden of actually showing that no, there will be higher Medicaid enrollment or higher CHIP enrollment or higher enrollment in the state employee health plan in a way that actually shows that the individual mandate being zeroed out harms states themselves. I think it's quite a stretch. And so that's one of the arguments that's been being made. Part of the other, but there have also been arguments about jurisdiction and standing on the other side. So because the Department of Justice is no longer sort of defending the lawsuit, defending the ACA, the court kind of threw a curveball, the Fifth Circuit threw a curveball about a week before oral argument asking for briefing on whether, if there's no sort of live case or controversy, if you just have the government agreeing with the plaintiffs here, should this still be in court at all? And, you know, do the Democratic states, the California-led states in the House, do they have standing to appeal the decision? And so not only are you sort of arguing about whether there's injury to the plaintiffs to bring the case in the first place, you then had a bunch of discussion and a lot of briefings about whether the defendant states, whether California and that coalition is harmed by the court's decision. I think the answer there is clearly yes. There's maybe some more interesting and trickier legal questions for whether the U.S. House would have standing on its own. Is the House itself injured by the lawsuit? But I think it's quite clear that the states are. California and, you know, that group of 21 states would face hundreds of billions of dollars of losses in federal funds if the ACA is invalidated. And I think that sort of suggests enough that they would have standing if it came to that. What we did see from the briefings on that specific question, every single party agrees there is sort of a live case or controversy. They think the case should be continued. It goes to what you were saying, Shira, you know, the federal government continues to enforce the law. They appealed the decision. They're sort of trying to all make the argument, and they're actually all in agreement on this point, that there is a continued issue and controversy between the plaintiffs and the Trump administration. So no one thinks you should have to get into whether the House or the states have standing, but that's it did cause kind of a ruckus, as she remembers quite well, and we're sort of really confused and trying to read the tea leaves the week before oral arguments to see, oh my God, does this mean they're going to sort of throw out the case? Are they not going to decide? Are they going to just affirm the lower court's decision? All of that. Again, it turns out everyone agrees. And I think that's right. I think the law is pretty clear based on some Supreme Court precedent that the case should continue to proceed, and you actually don't have to get into the questions of the California and the House's standing, although I think the plaintiff's standing is still a live issue. I'm sorry if that was super confusing. That was very in the weeds, and I'm happy to clarify anything. I know that was a lot just now.
Okay, and so now let's move on to what happened in the oral arguments a few weeks ago, and last week, feels like several weeks, and what sort of decision are we going to see? It seems very uncertain. Nobody really has a good answer, but read the tea leaves for us a little bit.
Sure. So, you know, it's really challenging to make predictions, and I was teasing Ridgely earlier, like, oh, I'm so glad this will be recorded so I can know exactly how wrong I was in making some of these predictions, but bear with me. A little bit of background on sort of the panel, right? So the Fifth Circuit is generally viewed as one of the most conservative appellate courts in the country. I forget the exact breakdown of the entire circuit itself, but this case, Texas v. United States, was assigned to a three-judge panel. Judge King, who was appointed by Carter, and then Judge Elrod, who was appointed by George W. Bush, and then Judge Englehart, who was appointed by George W. Bush to the district court level and then promoted, I guess, or appointed to the Fifth Circuit by President Trump. And, you know, reading the tea leaves there, you sort of have two Republican-appointed judges and one Democrat-appointed judge. And so the hearing was interesting. The two Republican-appointed judges, Judges Elrod and Englehart, asked a ton of questions, and Judge King was silent for the entire hearing. I don't think she spoke a word. And so you really kind of had my take on it was pretty aggressive questioning for California and the House of Representatives, and very pointed questions, I should say, about things like standing, about the constitutionality of the mandate, and about severability. There was a lot of interrupting. There was a lot of very sort of specific questions. I should say each sort of side had 45 minutes, and it was kind of divided amongst these big five groups of parties. And so, California and the House went first and really did kind of take a lot of questions. That was then followed by Texas and then the DOJ and then the two individual plaintiffs, sort of again dividing up the 45 minutes, and then you went back to California in the House for a bit of a rebuttal and more questions from the judges. And so my sense, having listened to it, was, yeah, there were some really pointed questions for California in the House. There were certainly questions fielded to the other side towards Texas and the DOJ, but it for whatever reason, it just didn't feel as strong in those cases. Even the DOJ was really struggling. If I was struggling to sort of articulate their position, I think the same was true for them in court. Had a really difficult time the court kind of pushed and said, what are you really saying? You think this lower court decision would only apply in the 18 plaintiff states? And what would that mean? And, you know, how are you viewing this as a government? And, you know, the attorney who was arguing the case just kind of said, that's a technical issue. It's a technical detail. We'll work that out later. Kind of said, this is getting appealed. This is my take. This is not a quote. But, you know, this is getting appealed. And so that's the kind of thing that will be worked out eventually. It's kind of remarkable whether the law applies in all 50 states or just 18 or doesn't apply, I should say, in all 50 states or just 18 was sort of a technical issue. Which, you know, I think the people living in those states would argue otherwise. And so those were the types of questions. But even when the DOJ had kind of trouble articulating exactly what their position was, it seemed like they didn't get as tough of questions as maybe California in the House did. So, you know, by and large, listening to it and hearing the direction of some of the questions, most folks are sort of thinking that the individual mandate is going to be held unconstitutional. They seemed, when pressed, they seemed very skeptical of the idea that the mandate could be upheld. They sort of were not taking that argument in from California in the House. And so a lot of the questions focused on the severability part of this. And I personally don't have a good indication of what direction they might go there. My sense is what they might do is rule or conclude that the mandate's unconstitutional. And they could say, we do think the law, there are parts of the ACA that should be struck down alongside the mandate. But we're not going to decide that as a Fifth Circuit. We're actually going to send that back down to the district court, back to Judge O'Connor, to do some more to do some more analysis of that. There were a number of questions about whether they should be sending anything back down to Judge O'Connor, which is what is making me think that. I could be totally wrong, but we'll see. That's my sense. But, you know, a lot of it was focused on how much of the law should stay and how much of the law should go. And sure, I didn't sort of give the full range of options of what they could rule. But let me know when you want me to go through that. That was just kind of my opinion of where things are.
Let me just interrupt one more time just to say that if anybody has questions as we're going along, send them to sabu@sabu.org because now's your chance. Okay. Go on. Keep going.
Yeah.
This is great.
And in addition to that, there has been a lot of discussion among legal scholars about which parts of the law could potentially fall, which parts are severable and not severable. And I know some legal scholars are trying to come up with lists right now to prepare for the court to give them, you know, what they could potentially strike down and not. So I know that's been a discussion happening in the legal community since the appellate arguments ended.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's been a big focus. I personally think the severability, this should be such a clear case. Even if you were going to assume that reasonable minds could disagree about the constitutionality of the mandate, I personally think that California and the House have made compelling arguments that it is still constitutional, but even let's take that off the table and sort of assume reasonable minds could disagree about that. I think the severability analysis from Judge O'Connor was just so far out of line with existing Supreme Court precedent and kind of the congressional intent that, you know, sort of trying to pick and choose what provisions fall and what provisions stay is really difficult. You know, it's really sheer to make those lists that you're talking about. It's really challenging because, you know, what I would say is we know exactly what Congress wanted to do here because it's what they did. They only zeroed out the mandate penalty. That's all they wanted to do. And so it should be really clear and it shouldn't go much further than that. So it's, I think there's a reason it's a struggle for folks to come up with that list because it doesn't make sense. Congress spoke, they only zeroed out the penalty and that was it. And that should be enough. And the analysis should sort of stop there. Is the way that most legal scholars think about this. And again, I haven't heard any sort of serious legal scholar, sort of conservative or progressive, say otherwise. And so it's hard. We're all tied up in pretzels and tied up in knots trying to think through what the potential implications could be and how do you unring the bell of the ACA that's been in place for 9 years based on this one change. And it's challenging because it would be incredibly unprecedented.
And so when are we expecting a decision in the appellate case and what would be the next step in this lawsuit?
Yeah, great question. So we don't have a strong sense of timeline. I'm sort of expecting something within 2 to 3 months. I think on average it takes the Fifth Circuit about 10 months to file a decision from the time it receives an appeal. You know, this case was appealed in January. You can imagine something coming in October. They didn't give any indication at oral argument. Sometimes judges do. These did not. And so we'll sort of see, but I would expect something kind of in the 2 to 3 month time frame. So we'll get something this fall is what most folks are expecting. And from there, I think it really depends on what the Fifth Circuit does here in terms of what happens next. So they have a range of options. Again, if you sort of think of it as a spectrum, on one end of the spectrum, they could completely reverse the lower court's decision. They could overturn Judge O'Connor's decision and say, we disagree, we think the mandate's constitutional, and the rest of the ACA should stand. If they do that, there is the possibility that maybe the Supreme Court, regardless of what they rule, I think there's going to be an attempt to appeal to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court can choose which cases it wants to take. And when it does that, all it takes is sort of four justices on the Supreme Court vote privately to say, yes, we would like to hear this case on appeal. And so there's, you know, conventional wisdom is that if the Fifth Circuit fully reverses Judge O'Connor's decision and says the ACA is valid, there's a world in which the Supreme Court might deny cert. They might say, you know what, we're not really trying to take our third blockbuster ACA existential threat case to the ACA, and we're really not trying to do it in an election year because a lot of this would head into 2020. We'll see. It only takes four votes, and so there might be four justices who want that case to come to the court, regardless of what the Fifth Circuit says. So that's one side of the spectrum, if you fully reverse Judge O'Connor's decision. The other side of the spectrum would be you affirm his decision completely, and so then there's a world in which the Fifth Circuit says, yeah, that was right. The mandate's unconstitutional, and the rest of the ACA is invalid. And I think if that happens, this absolutely goes up to the Supreme Court. I think there's no way it doesn't. And then there's something, you know, there's a potential for something in the middle. And that would be sort of maybe what I was suggesting earlier, where the Fifth Circuit says, well, the mandate's out, but we're not quite sure of the scope of everything else that should be out. So they either make that decision themselves or they send it back to Reed O'Connor to kind of keep going. I think all of that would be appealed up. It's just going to be really interesting to see what the Supreme Court does here and whether they accept this appeal. I'm imagining that they will, but it is fully their decision, and we sort of don't know. The timing of when the Fifth Circuit decision comes, though, I think also matters for the Supreme Court decision, when this gets before the Supreme Court. So there's a world in which we get a decision from the Fifth Circuit in, I don't know, September, October. That could give enough time for this to be added to the 2019 to 2020 docket for the Supreme Court, which, again, if they take the case, could set us up for sort of another blockbuster ACA decision next summer at the height.
Right in the middle of the 2020
election season. That's right. And so you have another big ACA case in an election year. Or if the decision from the Fifth Circuit comes later, maybe you lose that window, and then this gets added to the 2020-2021 Supreme Court docket. So I think it really, you know, two things there, right? It really depends what the Fifth Circuit rules, how motivated are the justices on the Supreme Court going to be to take this case one way or another, and then the timing of when that happens, and is it so urgent that this gets added to sort of the 2020 mix of what's before the Supreme Court there. And again, this is another time to emphasize nothing changes. Even if it's not till 2021 that we might be looking at a decision, you know, folks would keep their coverage and all of that, but it's just really confusing for people in the meantime.
So we did get a question. I don't know if you've seen it, Shira, but
I have seen it, and I'm planning on asking it in a moment.
Okay, I will be quiet. Okay, great. Go.
Great, and just for everyone to keep in mind, no matter what, even if the Supreme Court does take it in the middle of the 2020 election, even if they don't take it till 2021, this is going to continue to be a political issue for Democrats. Leading up to the oral arguments last week, they were holding press conferences all over Capitol Hill, holding up the faces of people who have benefited from the Affordable Care Act. I'm expecting to see this be Democrats won the midterm elections on protecting pre-existing conditions. I expect them to continue beating this drum as we approach the 2020 election. Katie, we know that this is turning healthcare markets upside down and will continue to do so, but what will be the potential impacts on the law, and how could it hurt this administration?
In terms of sort of political repercussions?
Yeah, and also the policy work that they're trying to do.
Sure. No, oh, sure, good point. So, you know, I think market impacts, right? These are, even if you just take the insurance provisions, insurance companies really like certainty. And so this is yet another point of uncertainty that's being injected, in my opinion, needlessly into the health insurance system. And, you know, so far, I think we haven't seen it play a big role, but we'll see what the Fifth Circuit says. And does it increase premiums? Does it make insurance companies skittish, and do they pull out of market? You know, so far we're not seeing any of that. So far premiums are relatively stable. You actually have more competition coming in, but it is sort of a cloud that's hanging over everything. Again, it's kind of like we've been here before. This is the third time, and so maybe it's just not as scary anymore, but that's actually happening, I think, in the market. But in terms of the rest of the healthcare system, right, even if you sort of look more broadly than insurance, to your point, this, you know, a lot of what the Trump administration is trying to do and its healthcare work and its drug transparency work, for instance, is use authority that exists under the ACA through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. You know, that's what gives them the authority to do really aggressive pilot programs and demonstration projects and, you know, then replicate that throughout Medicare and Medicaid. And if you don't have that authority, which is based on the ACA, are you actually kind of stymieing your own health policy goals and ideals and that kind of thing? So I think there's a lot that the Trump administration is doing that actually relies on ACA authority, and maybe not a full recognition of if this law is struck down here, all the things that would happen. But yeah, there are just so many impacts. What would happen if the biosimilar approval pathway at the FDA was suddenly invalidated? You know, some of those drugs are already out in the market in terms of being biosimilars. Are they suddenly unapproved and illegal? You know, what would any of this even mean? And I think it would get worked out. It would have to, but it would cause a lot of chaos and a lot of trouble. You know, Medicaid expansion would end. And so what do you do with millions of people who've been enrolled and hospitals that have come to count on that revenue source of people having insurance, all of that? I mean, it's your point about trying to make the list of what would happen if this was actually, you know, the way the court would decide. I mean, it would be mass chaos for an industry that is, you know, 20% of our economy.
Mm-hmm. We did get a question asking how it would affect quality and safety reporting for healthcare facilities, and does the lawsuit address those consumer-facing aspects? My sense is no, we don't really have a sense, but am I wrong on that?
You know, I know what you're talking about. So there were a number of, I think quality and safety reporting is quite broad, but I can think of examples like the hospital-acquired infection program. You know, there were a number of bonus programs and lots of sort of safety reporting things. A lot of that was in the ACA. Some of it is in statute, so some of it's explicit. Other parts of it were things that were rolled out through CMMI, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. So I don't know how much of that is independent from the ACA, and it seems like a lot more of that would be on kind of the Medicare side, which I'm less familiar with. But I think it's safe to say it would raise a lot of questions about all these different implications, for sure. And definitely some of that was in the law. And so then do you go, okay, well, what? Maybe we just revert back to what the law was in 2009 or in 2010 before we passed the ACA. And then how do you sort of start to undo some of the things that you've been working on for 9 years? So maybe we still have some quality reporting, but then it's supposed to look how it did 10 years ago. And what, you know, how are you supposed to transition back to that? And if it sounds absurd, it's because it would be absurd to go back in this way. And again, I think that's where kind of the severability question comes in. Like, clearly Congress, when it zeroed out the individual mandate penalty, was not thinking about hospital-acquired infections and quality reporting and was not thinking about CMMI and all these different changes. And so the idea that you would kind of use this one change to undo this giant statute that touches every part of the healthcare system is, it's extreme. It's an extreme decision to have been made.
We know that some states have taken some actions to try and mitigate some of the potential effects. Can you talk about some of those actions?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is a lot of states kind of at a minimum, we call it baking in some of the patient protections. For instance, passing their own laws that would enshrine things like guaranteed issue and community rating and protection for people with pre-existing conditions into state law. This was especially true, I think, when the Department of Justice had its first position, which was that some of those provisions should also fall. You had a lot of states, and even in this most recent legislative session in states, putting those protections into state law and saying, we'll do this even if the federal government isn't protecting these rights. You also have states who are doing their own state-level individual mandates and you know, trying lots of different things. I mean, states are, like the insurance industry, I would say, kind of not haven't fully reacted to this yet. I don't know of a ton of contingency planning, for instance. If anything, they're trying to bolster the ACA in their state, and I think that's what we're seeing with a lot of these state laws. What I will say is, you know, if there's kind of a middle of the road opinion, if you will, where the court strikes down the mandate and some of those protections for people with pre-existing conditions, I think that, you know, some of these state laws would fill in the gaps. But what I would say is if the court goes further and strikes down things like the premium tax credits and a bunch of the federal funding for all of this, there's really only so much states can do. And so you do see states playing and trying to insulate themselves from, you know, a bad decision to a degree, but the loss of a lot of federal money, either for tax credits or Medicaid expansion, no state in the country could make up that gap. And so that, I think they're doing what they can, but there really is only so much that they could do, depending on what the decision itself is.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't, we've kind of gotten to every aspect of this lawsuit that we know about, but this isn't the only lawsuit that's happening around the ACA right now. What's some of the other litigation that you're watching?
Yeah, so I know you're all very jealous, but I'm tracking about 40 to 50 decisions or like cases at any given time, and that's sort of just squarely ACA kind of insurance provisions. That does not include, for instance, Medicaid work requirements or some of the Title X litigation that we've been seeing, but there's just a ton of litigation out there. I think for kind of business reporters in particular, I would flag the risk corridors decision, which this is going to be the next ACA case that the Supreme Court has. The Supreme Court granted cert earlier this year to agree to hear an appeal in that case. And so there it's about whether insurance companies are entitled to payments from 2014 through 2016, to sort of full payments. And, you know, it's an ACA case. The statute comes from the ACA that they're arguing about. But I would sort of say it's a much broader issue. It's not limited to the ACA. This is really about whether the government is a good partner with private industry. And I think the idea is that insurance companies kind of engaged and decided to partner with the feds under the promise or under the understanding that they would receive these payments, and they did not. And so, you know, you have, for instance, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has not been supportive of the ACA at all, sort of filing a brief urging the Supreme Court to take the case because this is so important to understanding the realm of public-private partnership in this country. So that's a risk corridors case that's going to be before the Supreme Court this next term. I think they just asked for a filing extension, you know, a deadline extension in their filing, but suggested maybe oral arguments would be held in December. That's something to keep an eye on. So we'll kind of see when that decision comes out. I'm similarly watching a lot of the lawsuits over unpaid cost-sharing reductions, which is like the risk corridors getting into the billions of dollars now. Risk corridors, insurance companies are owed over $12 billion, and so cost-sharing reductions continues to kind of move in that direction. So far, insurance companies have uniformly won their lawsuits over unpaid cost-sharing reductions. Folks might remember this. This was a decision that President Trump made back in 2017 to cut off those payments, and you had a number of states and insurance companies doing things in response to that. It did not sort of destabilize the market as folks thought. In the meantime, you've got insurance companies suing, saying we're owed that money, and they're winning across the board. That's a big one. I'm also tracking things like litigation over the association health plans and short-term plans, some of the kind of non-ACA alternative plans that the Trump administration has really opened up access to. They lost on the on association health plans. I'm sort of waiting any day now for a decision from Judge Leon in D.C. over the short-term plan rule, just to see, you know, kind of what comes next there. So that's kind of a lot of stuff. There's a bunch of cases out there. I'm always happy to chat about, you know, whatever folks need or whatever is most interesting. But we're doing a lot of health policy by litigation these days. For better or worse.
Yeah.
It really is an incredible amount of lawsuits out there.
I mean, the Trump administration is dealing with it too. They just lost the decision last week about their rule requiring drug companies to put their list prices in their advertisements. So we're not just seeing litigation happening from, you know, a couple of years ago and from the original of Obamacare, but we're seeing it happen with the Trump administration's plans as well. Okay. Well, I think that was everything that we wanted to address. Is there anything else, Katie, that you wanted to make sure that people are thinking about when it comes to covering Obamacare or covering this lawsuit or covering the ACA in general?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I don't think so. I think we've emphasized it enough times that it's really important to make it clear to folks what their rights are and that, you know, you don't want to scare people needlessly. But it is a big decision with a lot of repercussions, and it's just going to be a matter of kind of, at least on this big case, seeing what the Fifth Circuit rules and taking it from there. But nothing else from my perspective. I think thank you for hosting this conversation, and hopefully it wasn't too confusing. I know it gets in the weeds pretty quickly, so thanks for bearing with me, all of you listening.
Well, I think this was a masterclass. This is Ridgely and the ACA, and I think both of you all did a brilliant job, and I so appreciate it. Are there specific dates that people should be sort of putting in their calendars? I mean, you know, I guess we don't know when the Fifth Circuit's going to do anything, right? That's going to be,
eight months
from now, or?
It could be whenever they wanted, practically. But I would just say keep an eye on court dockets. I'm keeping a close eye on court dockets. Katie also does a really great job of writing up every single thing that happens in this case for Health Affairs.
Yes.
So if you don't see it the day it happens, she will have it up the day or there the next day explaining it. So that's been very helpful.
Yes, I was going to give another plug for that. It's very, very, very helpful. Well, thank you both very much, and we'll stay tuned. This is not going away, oddly enough. We thought we decided it a couple times, but one more time with feeling. So anyway,
thank you both. Commonwealth Fund.
Okay, thank you Commonwealth Fund, and thank you both. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.